Okay, welcome to the Ed Listen podcast, episode number 3, Decade in Review. Let's see. My name is Bjorn Berendt, and I'm here with
Skylar LeBombard.
And we'd like to thank you for listening. First thing I want to talk about is some actually educational news. And it's very specific to Vermont, but it's the 3dvermont.org program. I don't know if you've ever heard of this.
I had not, no.
Okay, well, with it, it's basically students go out and they research a building in their town. They have to do full research on it, a full presentation on it, and then they go into, and then they have to build a 3D model of it. MEMS is actually doing it with all of their students, and then they're going to pare it down. And then on March 27th, they're going up to Vermont Technical College, and they're presenting it, and it's being judged, and there's prizes to be won. The middle school, usually the big prize is a bunch of Chromebooks. The high school usually gets a free 3D printer out of it. So that's actually something worth checking out. It's 3dvermont.org. And the reason why I bring it up is where my daughter goes to school, they weren't going. So I've paired up and I've actually become the parent volunteer that's doing this. So my daughter's going to be getting a bunch of her friends to get it together. And I think they're going to do the one of the buildings in Wallingford. So it's really excited. She's been hearing me talk about it for the past 3 years. So
I know that MEMS last year did some modeling of historical buildings or something, but I don't believe that it was like integrated with technology as much as this seems like it will be. So it's pretty interesting.
Well, they were there last year.
Oh, they were. So that must have been. So yeah, I guess I have heard of it. I just didn't know that it was named anything specific.
Yeah, and I actually went down to one of the classrooms and showed them Wii video so they could build their presentations.
Cool. Very cool.
Already. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm going up for, you know, my own daughter and for MEMS. It's something I'm hoping to grow for next year too with all the other middle schools.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was amazed at the work that I saw out of MEMS last year, and I know that the kids were really proud. Like, it was on display for quite a while in the school. So
it's amazing because they have this huge 50-foot banner of the of Vermont, and they'll put all the 3D models on it. So it's really fun to go to.
And where is it hosted?
Vermont Technical College in Randolph.
Got it. Yep.
Definitely worth checking out, and definitely if you're in Vermont, check that out. get a team together. Okay, moving on to that was kind of some EDU news. How about the meat and potatoes of the show? I'm going to let you take the lead on this one because this was your idea and I loved it.
Sure. So I think it was over holiday break when we took a little hiatus and everybody recharged their batteries. I got an email from the EdSurge.com website. They sent out, I think, monthly newsletters that just go over some of the articles that have been coming out. And this one specifically was a collection of articles that was a reflection on 10 years of educational technology. So essentially from 2009 to, I guess, 2020 at this point, which still seems weird to say. We're a week in. I had a conversation with my wife last night, actually. We were watching Netflix and we talked about a show that we had watched when we had first met. And she was like, that was 12 years ago. And I was like, really? I think it was 11. And I was like, whoa, it is 2020. So that's still a little unsettling. But really looking at this collection of articles, it makes it seem like 10 years wasn't that long ago. But when you look at some of the devices that they're talking about in the particular article that I read, the iPhone was 2 years old.
I mean, yeah, the movie thing, I just keep bringing up movies. Actually, we're watching like DuckTales and stuff with my kids since we got Disney Plus. And I'm like, I remember that new, and that's really old.
Yeah. Yeah. So with this collection of articles, I had sent you an email and said, what do you feel about selecting one of the many articles that are part of this collection that it's just kind of a reflection on 10 years in educational technology, and we'd each select an article and read it and discuss it on the podcast. And some of them obviously have a through line so we can make connections there. And I really only did read one because it was on vacation. So I was interested in like, this is a topic that I'm really interested in. So I'll give it some time. And then I did some reflection on that. And then, you know, I figured you would select one, and I made sure that we didn't select the same one so that we'd have a couple of different content areas, I guess. And yeah, so that's the idea.
Now, how did you choose that? How did you know I wasn't going to do this? Because I waited to the last minute to read one of these. Did you even wait even longer?
No, I mean, I read when I initially hit, I read one called Beyond Screen Time. Obviously, I'm a father of two young children, and that is of particular interest. And you and I have had plenty of discussions around the malignment of screen time in general and how it's just viewed as a bad thing for students. So it's of particular interest. And the article that I read just hit that interest point for me. And I read it and figured there was enough other articles so that we wouldn't have crossover. So,
yeah, I think the article that I read is "What Problems Has EdTech Solved and What New Ones Did It Create?" And I actually kind of like, I started reading one other one, but I'm like, nah, that's either too overdone. But let me hear about yours first.
Okay. So, as I said, the article was titled Beyond Screen Time. It's the subtitle is Better Questions for Children in Technology in 2020. So in 2020, which is where we are now still. It blows my mind. So this article goes over the importance of content and context in determining the uses of technology, which are beneficial for young children. In some of the discussions that you and I have had in my office just casually, we've talked about the alignment of educational technology so far. And it's this idea, there was a period in the last 10 years where money was just thrown at one-to-one devices without any thought about implementation. And it was, look how great our school system is doing because we have one-to-one devices. Very little forethought was put into how much student contact time is used, how it's overseen by teachers, and things of that nature. So I've always been one to say, you can't malign screen time if you're not looking at the content that the kids are looking at or the context in which they're looking at it. So if, as a parent, whenever my child's on a screen, I'm usually sitting next to them, discussing with them whatever it is they're watching. Certainly if it's educational in nature, talking about, you know, how that affects real life. So as I previously stated, one of the things that stuck out to me was in 2009, the iPhone was 2 years old. It wasn't designed for children, but it quickly found its way into small hands. And before we knew it, they were clicking, tapping, and swiping. And that brought with it apps for teaching and learning, communication, collaboration, connecting, social, emotional learning. All of those things exist on smart devices at this point. So the article then dives into gaps in research and how 10 years really of this technology existing isn't really enough to determine best practices leveraging for education or child development. So what is leaned on is 50 years of research around screen time with television.
Now, did it address the fact that, I mean, that's one of the things of mine addressed is the fact that then there's a disconnect between, let's see, the technology coming out and changing versus is it out long enough to then be effective or learn for people to learn how to make it effective, I guess it is.
Yeah. So one of the bold bullet points. So the article discusses kind of the last 10 years, what it's brought with it, its implications on getting in the hands of children and how to be responsible, and whether or not 50 years of research about TV habits should inform understanding how they use digital devices. Then there's a series of bullets. One of them is old theory informs the new use of tools. So Maria Montessori, Jean Piaget, Lev Vygotsky, B.F. Skinner, Howard Gardner, all of those educational theorists say that even if tools, technologies, and context change rapidly, childhood development is what child development is. So it's a constant. So to your point, in research, the one constant is what we know about child development, even though all of the tools are changing constantly. So when you're looking at longitudinal studies, it's difficult to really get anything of value because by the time you've had enough and taken enough sample size and looked at the impact over the year, or obviously multiple years, in this case, a decade, right? the technology has changed so rapidly in that decade, it's hard to point to causation. Derek goes into additionally like how relationships matter most. Right. So it actually as talks about Mr. Rogers.
Pretty soon.
Which I think is timely. Why don't I start with Mr.
Timely,
Rogers?
Because Tom Hanks is Mr. Rogers in theaters.
All right. So one of the bullet points in this article, also it's bold and it says relationships matter most. And it talks about Mr. Rogers and it says it's not about technology, it's about relationships. So that's something that as an educational leader, as a classroom teacher, certainly as a curriculum director, programming cannot take the place of a human relationship. So the people that are put in front of you, you're responsible for the development. So anticipating that they'll be functional human beings when you put them in front of a screen, and if that's the only thing you do, that's not going to work. It also goes further and talks about essentials as far as play and social interaction and how they're essential for childhood development, and there is no technology to replace that. And that proper pedagogy complements technology tools. So it's, you really need to know what you're doing as a teacher in order to leverage the technology and have it be functional. And also one of the things that it states is technology interactions with families is an important part of leveraging educational technology. So things in our instance, I know we have a school that uses Blooms, which is an iPhone or I'm assuming Android app as well for family communication. We use Alma, our SIS, to communicate with families as well. And as far as I'm concerned, I appreciate things being in my pocket. So personal experience, when I get a message from school, my daughter's nursery school uses Blooms. So I get updates from there. Class Dojo is something that my other daughter, her pre-K, used. So I appreciate the messaging and kind of direct line to the parent or to the parents as an educator, but also to the teacher as a parent.
Yeah, I think there's been a few teachers that use Google Classroom and I've gotten the Guardian email through that. And I loved it throughout elementary school. And I wish they would embrace that more.
Yeah, I think as a system, just being reflective on where we are with six different schools, there's six different cultures, six different personalities. So you and I have had to deal with that a little bit as far as this school wants to use this mechanism, this school wants to use that mechanism. Is one better than the other that kind of serve the same function? So it's difficult to have those conversations. But because we're six schools and we have school choice for middle school, trying to align those systems so that it's a common experience for a parent starting in kindergarten all the way up through middle level is probably the best bet. Every time I reach into my pocket and have to download a new app, I always cringe a little bit because I know I'll forget about it or it'll take the place of something else. So whenever we use any parent communication tools that are new, it's a little bit challenging. And I feel like the access to the pools of parents that we might get if we were consistent across the board would be much larger. So that essentially is the bulk of my article. At the very end, it talks about eight different areas that warrant further attention. Number one is research. And to your point, as you said, technology changes so rapidly, it's difficult to get any longitudinal research. Evidence-based classroom practices for new technologies, including AI, VR, voice-activated tools, coding, and computational thinking. High standards for ethical design. Obviously, we're using these pieces of technology with children, so ethics is pretty high. And they need to be child-centered. Then it talks about equity and diversity, including issues of access in the digital divide. So some communities don't have access. The bring your device to school days are great for the kids that have the devices, but not every kid has one. So it's an equity issue. Children's rights in a digital environment. Obviously, digital citizenship for both adults and children, cyber safety, online privacy, contributing positively to society instead of being a troll. Like that's important for kids to know. Empowering grownups to be media mentors, including those practices that distract us from being present. So as a parent in a digital age where everyone has a screen in their pocket, I will go out to dinner with my family and I will look across the restaurant and see plenty of parents there also with their children, but the parent is staring at a screen.
Yeah, it's mixed on. Yeah.
So it's
mixed because some parents that's common, some parents it isn't. I can't say I'm the best example of that, but I can. It's funny. I gave my kids their technology really early, but with it came a lot of responsibility. Like, my daughter fought me tooth and nail because she wanted Snapchat. I'm like, 2 years. I mean, at least for the past 2 years, she's like, I want Snapchat. I'm like, you're not 13. I want Snapchat. You're not 13. I think we gave in a little bit early, just because her social network, when she went into middle school, that's how she communicated with her friends. We still keep a very close eye on it. So we know what's going on with her things. We know her passwords. She knows she has no privacy on her phone. But
yeah, I mean, my niece, who is 8, saved up a bunch of money and bought an iPod Touch. So she uses it for FaceTime with our family. She uses it for Messenger. My oldest daughter is about to turn 6. So she is interested in getting herself an iPod so that she can communicate with her cousin. And then FaceTime her grandparents and her aunts and uncles and things of that nature. So one of the caveats I put was on this idea of getting her something. I mean, she has an Amazon Fire tablet because we use it for ABC Mouse and a bunch of other educational programming. She's really interested, and I think it's just the size of the iPod. The caveat I gave her was that she needs to learn how to read. So she's really... But she's this is where it gets interesting, right? So she's trying really hard, and obviously she's turning 6, so things are really starting to click. So given that caveat of you need to learn to read in order to use this, she responds, well, Dad, why do I need to learn to read or to spell when I can just tell it what I want it to say and it'll type it for me?
That is very insightful.
It's kind of like the verbal touche from a 5-year-old. So the last point of the 8 points that for future thought in 2020 is improving teacher preparation and parent development for more intentional and appropriate use in classroom and homes. So I think that's important. I'm helping parents understand. Helping parents understand what's going on in school with the use of technology. Certainly we have one-to-one. A lot of families have that same perspective that I think we were plagued with earlier on in the decade when schools went to one-to-one. And certainly with proficiency-based learning, is it all automated? Do we have something that's going to measure proficiency? Is it taking the place of the teachers? And essentially, I've worked with teachers that feel threatened by technology. So when smart boards first hit eons ago, it threatened the chalkboard users. And there are still chalkboards not far from here.
Yeah, that's funny. That's a good transition into my article, you know, what problems has EdTech solved? And let's see, actually, one of the questions in this article that they mention was what predictions never panned out? And I'm jumping down in my article a little bit here, but it was a book called Disrupting Class, How Disruptive Innovation Will Change the Way the World Learns. And I didn't quote who wrote it. In the article it does, and you'll see that in the show notes. But in this book, supposedly by 2019, half of all high school classes will be taught over the internet. That was their prediction. And, you know, I'm coming from a high school. That's where my previous job was. And no. There's pockets of it, and it's used for supplementary. You know, either a student is interested in something that's not available, or the student really needs to get something that the school can't provide just because of size and welcome to Vermont. So it's supplemental, but it's not become the norm. It's not, there's no core classes that are just taught online that at least in for most of Vermont.
Yeah. So this actually is great, because I don't know if I've ever had this conversation with you, and it's certainly timely because we're going to start approaching the time where we start to look at if we're going to do this again. We are only a K-8 system, so algebra is a 9th grade program. We have kids that are pretty advanced in mathematics, so we established some criteria that they would have to meet. We have 3 functional middle schools that students have school choice for. So algebra and geometry in this instance this year is offered only on one campus, geometry is. So we have students that are at schools that are 35 minutes away from where that offering is, and it's before school. So it's in addition to their regular educational programming. We had to figure out how to accommodate these three kids. I think there's three, there may only be two this year, that should have access to this instruction. So the initial thought was look at Vermont Virtual Learning Collaborative, which is something that we had used in the past. Parents weren't necessarily satisfied with that option. Local administrators weren't necessarily satisfied with that option. They still felt that, that there should be an adult in the room kind of monitoring what's going on. So when I took this position that I'm in now, one of the solutions I had put out there was, why can't we live stream, get kids to school early? The other, there were a lot of hurdles. Our school start times are all different, which is it's kind of mind-boggling. So last year we ran an algebra course that was 100% online for three students at one of our schools. And I don't know that they ever physically met the teacher. So they watched a live stream and they did all the work through Google Classroom. After some feedback from their experience, we've started to do a little bit of blended learning in a sense where most of it is online, but every Tuesday morning, there's a bus that takes them to that school so they can be in that classroom and establish those relationships. So it is kind of interesting, certainly not half of all high school courses, but it is, we have a little bit of that going on here. And I think it's interesting. It'll be interesting to explore. It'll be interesting to take a look at long-term student satisfaction, student performance. So we know that after they do algebra, they have to take a placement exam at, essentially, it comes down to Bern Burton usually. Something like 80%+ of our kids go to Bern Burton. Mm-hmm. So they take an algebra placement exam if they've had algebra in one of our schools. So the kids that are taking it at a distance, it'll be interesting to see over the years how they do. So that's just kind of our little local spin on this idea that 50% of high school courses should be online.
Well, what I've seen though is a not necessarily online, but a digitizing of curriculum to provide differentiation. So I'm actually thinking about like a lot of teachers who really embrace technology, really embrace differentiation. And what you see is their class becoming like an online guide that a student has to follow. And then the teacher is more of the guide with that. So you're there, I'm going to help you with this. You're there, I'm going to help you with this. And they kind of work through that process. That I've seen, and that has happened in over 50% of the classes, I would say, in high school and actually everywhere, where it's not totally online. It's not this video conferencing. It's now just a digitized way. Students can access the information anytime they want for pretty much the whole class or up to where they are at least. And so it's not a, I have to sit in class, take my notes, and that's the only information I get. Well, I can go home and review this. I can do this. So while I don't think it's been this online internet class, I do think classes are transitioning to a format that accepts this digital divide. And that format allows for students to not necessarily be directly in front of the teacher constantly. I think that allows for this blended. It allows. So I think if the class is set up specifically for blended learning or for online teaching, I think it can work. My poor wife, she took a master's degree and she took it online, but there were so many teachers that still taught the class as if they were in front of the classroom. So they had like hour-long lectures that she had to watch and relied completely on discussion boards and these papers. And they did not teach in such a way that mass worked with the technology, and therefore she didn't get as good an experience. Where I went through my master's degree was online, but it was all these educators who were trying to innovate. So they were really using the discussion, using this back and forth, short videos, short references to materials. And so I think that change is really something we've seen. It wasn't even in this article, but it is something I've personally seen. And while it didn't pan out to full video conferencing, what else? So in the article I read here, what problems has it solved? What problems did it create? I think the solution that the answer that many of the people who wrote, because it was a bunch of different, I don't want to say educators, because they look like CEOs from different companies. In some of the articles, you can tell they're selling their company. There's one who's Dreambox Digital Learning that's loved video conferencing. I read into that as like, okay, you're selling your product. I mean, you love what your product provides. But each of them did point out that what has been solved in the past decade was access to technology. And I know iPads have came in and they really didn't pan out the way they expected, which is one of the other questions in this article, saying how Chromebooks solve the sub $200 device that could be managed, where iPads, normal Apple, they led the innovation but didn't keep up with the mass launch of it. So that was kind of an interesting thing to say. Yes, access is now available. And if you look at most Vermont schools, I think a lot of them have adopted Chromebooks and gone that way, where every single student now has a device. Every single student now has access to the internet. And I loved this Jesse Woodley Wilson from Dreambox Learning. She says the problem now is not the access, but it is educators needing to focus on linking those edtech tools to the student learning outcomes. And I think that is currently one of the things we're trying to figure out, especially now that we all figured out how to get one-to-one in there, how to get you the access. Now, what do we do with the access? Let's see.
I think one of the, to your point about iPads, the rate of turnover or the end of life of generations of iPads and the requirement that you have to renew them, or certain operating systems or iOS doesn't support whatever edition of the app that you were using before. That may be a reason why iPads fell out of focus. I think that it's interesting that Chromebooks now are touchscreens, the ones that we are one-to-one with. So you kind of lose some of that allure of an iPad being a touchscreen. The rotating cameras that iPad is sold as, you can film with this. And now you can do all of that with a Chromebook that is not only cheaper, but more, I would say, more durable, easier to replace. And the support will be there because they're kind of basic.
Well, actually, I have an idea of why this happened. And this is pure opinion. And it's from me being from the tech side and then also getting working from the educational side. Yeah, my background's kind of wonky. I'm not a traditional educator. Long story short, iPads came from teachers. And it was a piece of technology that teachers found very useful personally. And it says, I want to bring this into the classroom, which oddly is how you think technology should come. I mean, that should be exactly how technology comes into the classroom. The problem was it came into the classroom through the teacher, and then it went to the IT department. And the IT department tried to take that one device designed for an individual and produce it to the masses. And that just didn't work. It was so hard to buy apps. It was so hard to manage. It became a management problem for the IT department. I don't think the tool of the iPad, I think the tool of the iPad as an individual is an amazing, amazing tool. It was, like my phone, it's become a Swiss Army knife, but you couldn't manage it in bulk. So, round about a few things. Then you have Chromebooks who are coming out. Now, Chromebooks didn't come from teachers. There's no teachers at home who had a Chromebook says, we need to bring this and put it in my classroom. This was the IT department saying, you love this, I can manage this, and bringing it in. And then the cost came down. And then what you saw was that Chromebooks, the early ones, they weren't as useful because it was just the internet. But what happened is they became the tool that the students had access to. And then developers kept getting bombarded with, we don't want the iPad. We have a Chromebook. keep making it. And so now you're starting to see a lot of these apps coming to Chrome and coming to being available on the Android store. So it's funny how iPads came from teachers and into the classroom, but it failed because they couldn't be managed or scaled up. Chromebooks came from the IT department, and it's had to, and the developers have had to scale up to make it match what the teachers can do. I don't know what's better or worse, but it's what happened.
Yeah, it sounds exactly. I mean, I know that you were just saying that it's opinion, but it makes a lot of sense. We just had an instance downstairs today about a teacher who was using an iOS device and purchased a quote unquote free app on her own Apple ID. So while the device might be her phone or it might be a computer owned iPad, either way, she's using her own Apple ID. The program is for 3 users, but all under 1 Apple ID. We would fund its purchase. So this is something that our accounting department was just dealing with. And I had a conversation with them about how it should go because they're used to just paying for an app straight up, but it's an in-app purchase. So it's just like, we'll give you a little taste. You like the app. Here's how you scale it out, $35 annually. And it's associated with your Apple ID. So in this instance, it's a speech and language pathologist. So theoretically, you can have multiple users on one account, but it's all under 1 Apple ID. So if she uses her personal Apple ID, she then compromises that if she wants to share it out with colleagues. So it's really interesting that we were just in this situation today. And I know when you go to the Chrome store, you don't have to deal with that. So it's just interesting to see. But yeah, I think your theory it's totally sound from what I'm hearing. It is.
And I actually saw it. I was started in the IT department business early enough that I saw it happen with Apple and Windows. Apple kind of like had their first leg in education, and they didn't build a product that could be scaled out, you know, in the management early enough. And Windows did, and they came in. And you watched the shift from Apple products to Windows, which blew up. And then Windows kind of got corporate, and then Chromebooks, I think, have come into that same spot. So, that kind of covers most of the article. I do want to – I'm curious on what your answer would be this. What do you think is the next trend or fad that will resurface in the next decade in educational technology?
So resurface means that it would have previously experienced some kind of – time in the limelight. Is that what I would interpret? So it's been at the forefront at some point. So resurfacing. So I can share a personal experience. Something like VoiceThread, I think, is something that I thoroughly enjoyed when I was doing some coursework around educational technology. And then I would work with it with classes. I think podcasting would be one of those things where, you know, you had this podcast and you went on a hiatus for a pretty lengthy time. I remember back when I was teaching fifth grade, 8 years ago-ish, wanting to do a classroom podcast and then starting to get the ball rolling, but then something else shiny came along and I, you know, put my efforts into that. I think that traditional media is kind of dying. Specifically, one of the apps that I was just discussing around the in-app purchase was this app that generates a newspaper weekly based on a student's individual reading level, which is different than one that we already have and that we already subscribe to as an organization. So you could use this app with kids that are from ages 6 to 14, it says on their website. So I'm confident a 6-year-old at this stage in the game doesn't even know what a newspaper is or was. Podcasting, I think, is this free opportunity for people to share their thoughts and views. What you're doing in some of the classrooms is fantastic. I feel like when I was young, I wanted to be on the radio. I was really into music. I'm a musician. I play guitar, a couple other instruments as well. And it's something that really interested me. My bachelor's degree is in mass media music production. Yeah,
that's where I was supposed to go to.
Yeah, and then I started working at a school with a couple of kids, and I got a master's in elementary education. And then from there, my next degree or certificate was in educational technology. And then I did my administrative work online, actually. So it's been an interesting journey as well. But I think podcasting is going, Spotify is buying up all of these little podcasting networks. There's very little regulation on them. I think that's an interesting point. I wonder if podcasting will start to see more regulation. I don't really know how you do that. Sponsors are usually pretty liberal about like what people do on their podcast, because you have to, there's not a chance that someone will accidentally tune into like the Joe Rogan Experience, where things are pretty, you know, the gloves are off and you don't really know what content's coming your way. So it's not like, you know, little Johnny on the corner is going to turn the dial and automatically and all of a sudden tune into the Joe Rogan Experience. You have to physically, you know, find it in a podcast distribution app and select to listen to it. But I really think that podcasting in the classroom is a great way to show learning. And I feel like as evidenced by the work that you're doing with our schools, the bar of entry is pretty low.
Yeah. No, I think that's really cool. It's funny. It's not in the article, but one of the fads that I remember toying with early on that died and then came back, avatars. My original, like, if you look online, I have the at symbol with the A+. That's me online. If you everywhere, that's what it was. It actually used to be a cartoon of me that my dad drew. And I remember going for a job interview or starting my original podcast. And I was talking to one of my educator friends, and she looked at me and says, "No one's going to take you seriously with that avatar. You got to change it." And that's where I changed it to the A+. I look now and like all these educators and everybody has their own avatar. It has become like the biggest thing to have is your own avatar. And I'm like, wow, maybe I should have stuck with it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember, I can't remember the name of the website it was, but I ran the after school program at the school where I was a teacher, and we had an after school session that was computers. We had a computer lab, very traditional. They were netbooks, they weren't Chromebooks. A lot of issues with those. But I remember the avatar fad in kids. It was, I want to say it was like Cartoon Yourself or something like that. And they had, it was just a drag and drop. You had a couple of selections for eyes and, you know, all of that stuff. We recently dusted off our Nintendo Wii because my almost 6-year-old likes bowling. So I was like, okay, well, she liked going to the bowling alley, but she has a 3-year-old sister who is a wild woman, and getting them to the bowling alley is kind of takes a bunch of time. So I taught her how to bowl on the Wii, and she was like, "Dad, I don't want to use your avatar, or I don't want to use, I can't remember what she called it. Obviously she didn't call it an avatar, but she's like, I want to make one that looks like me." And the look on this kid's face when we were picking out, you know, the nose, the eyebrows, in this instance, she's like, "I want some blush," right? So like, you can be whatever you want to be. It'll be interesting. I have seen that kind of have a resurgence as well, but it's funny because all of these things are kind of timely, and it makes me harken back to that computer club at after school where the kids wanted to do that and then they wanted to print it. And of course, as a public school, we didn't have a public, or we didn't have a color printer in the computer lab. So they were a little bit disappointed then, and then there was another website where you create your avatar and you could either type whatever you wanted it to say and the mouth would move, and they thought that was the coolest thing, or you could record audio and it would just repeat it.
Oh my God, we were doing that last year. We were playing a lot with augmented reality, which I think is going to, I think that's going to have a big impact in education in the next decade. I don't think the technology is quite there, but you can see it's right on that tipping point. And he was playing with one that was an avatar, and it tracked your head and it moved your mouth and everything else. And so you created this three-dimensional avatar. So not, and I think in this case, it was actually you could be a raccoon or something else. And it was neat. And I remember I also remember seeing it. It wasn't Minecraft. It was, there was another program that everybody kind of got together and had their own avatar. So yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of this. The article said personalized learning will have a renaissance in the next decade.
I don't know. To me, a renaissance suggests that there was once a golden age. I think it's an interesting perspective to think that it'll have a resurgence. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I see personalized learning having to happen with one-to-one. You know, it goes back to now that we have the access, how do we make it work? And that's where personalized learning, now we can have real personalized learning where people are at different directions.
I fear that what that'll turn into is you log a student in and they take a placement test. And then, so something like Khan Academy, where there's a series of lessons that are set up and it's less teacher contact time and less relationship building. I know that one of the things we're looking at with one of our assessments is this assessment company has that ability after you take an assessment. So it's no longer a placement test that takes place within the confines of their software. It is a current assessment that we take that's in place right now. And right now, after a teacher conducts the assessment, it is up to them to interpret the results and set a course of learning outside of any technology. The offering that they're putting out now, specifically for math, they're working on one for literacy, will then create a learning path for them, which is kind of a resurgence, if you will, of personalized learning. And it'll help that teacher. It takes some things off the plate for the teacher. And all the teacher would have to do is just make sure that what they're seeing when they work with the student matches what the student's working on. In that.
See, I'm hoping it's going to go the other way and it's going to help build relationships with teachers. Because you can't just sit in front of the class students and speak to them. You then have to get involved with what they're doing. This morning was an example of that when I was talking about the podcast with the third and fourth graders. I'm sitting here, I'm trying to tell them what, you know, talk to them about what's going on. And I'm realizing I'm just standing in front of the classroom and they're all just glazed. I said, okay, go ahead and talk with your group, try and find people to match up with. And they just turned and talked to the people next to them. You know, I let them do that. And then, you know, 5 minutes into it, I went to the teacher and like, can we switch it up? So I made them like one group get up and switch, and I forced them to switch. And at one point I forced them to actually get up and actually move. And I have this whole dance thing that I made them. And then, okay, now everybody get mixed up and then find your groups, you know, cause the chaos before you find that grouping. I think they wound up back in the same groups they originally were, but trying to get, and then when we were going around and they were having those conversations, there were some students who were like, I don't know what my podcast group is going to be about. Well, and then I had to have that conversation. Well, what is your interest? And it turned out to one of those interests was going to be gaming. So we have a podcast group that's going to be focused on gaming, and another one that's going to be focused on book reviews, and another one that's going to be focused on food. You know, and I think they're all going to have humor and like a joke of the day and things like that, but it's going to be a food joke and it's going to be a coding joke.
I think it's interesting that something that I think we should touch on maybe in a future episode is the idea of esports as well, and how, you know, some of those things are now school sponsored. And I don't know where that is in the state of Vermont, like what the status of that is. I know the Vermont Principals Association really works with athletics throughout the state. So I know the folks, Jay Nichols, the president of the VPA, and he is working to introduce kind of new sports throughout the state of Vermont. So you had Ultimate Frisbee happen in the last few years, and now bass fishing is a thing. It's really interesting. So I might have to send him an email to see, you know, what the status of esports is in the state and if there are clubs popping up or anything like that. I think that might be interesting to look at.
Actually, I know Fairhaven, they had one of the kids started an esports club, and he actually won a scholarship on one of the first competitions. A really good one too. I mean, it was a big deal. And you know, we've started building some computers for this. So I'm curious to see if we want to do this at the elementary middle school level where esports lands, but I don't think there should be a high school in Vermont that is not entertaining this, because it is a sport. And there's a group of kids who probably have been not the focus that really it lines with what their interests are. So,
right. Yeah, certainly interesting to explore.
Cool. Well, I'm going to move on to our 60-second challenge. This is actually going to be one of our longer podcasts. So I have a 60-second challenge. Have you ever heard of a Twitter chat? So what on Twitter, you have a hashtag. Every post that you make on Twitter is public. And the way you organize posts is with a hashtag. Well, Ed Chat is probably one of the first ones that came up, decided a long several years ago that on Tuesdays at 7 o'clock, they're going to post a question with the hashtag Ed Chat and have everybody have a discussion about this. It's like this really cool thing where people come together at a specific time and just kind of tweet all using the hashtag. And you can follow it along, and there's math chats, there's ELA chats, there's now chats for everything at specific times. And so my 60-second challenge is to – you don't have to participate. And we're going to post a link to the show notes to some Ed Chat times that I've seen. But I suggest jumping on board one of those times and lurking there for 60 seconds. If you want to lurk longer, if you want to communicate, that's awesome. But this is a 60-second challenge. It's just kind of – watch this chat happen for a little time. I think there's one tonight, so I might have to tonight at 7. I think it's the Ed Chat one that I saw, so I'm going to have to jump on board. By the way, we're recording this on a Tuesday.
Yeah, that actually works out because one of my daughter's dance classes doesn't end until after that time, so I'll have my phone out and maybe I'll hop on myself.
Okay, so anything else?
No, that's it.
Yeah, a little faux pas in the middle of this that I'm going to have to do some nice editing. But
what's the time? We'll
get it figured out.
What's the Zencaster time limit?
Right now we're at 37 minutes, and that's after the 13 minute. Recorded 13 minutes. My computer went to sleep. It stopped recording. I think yours probably stayed awake because it records local to yours and then uploads to mine. So note to self, get something to keep it from going to sleep. Okay. So I want to thank you for listening to the Ed Listen podcast with your host, Bjorn Berndt and
Skylar Bombard.
You can follow the podcast and contribute by going to www.edlisten and clicking on the podcast link. You can follow me on Twitter at edlisten.com. And we're now posted on quite a few different platforms, including Apple and Google. I think I'm still waiting for Stitcher, but we're out there. So
we're on Spotify as well.
So please check us out. And I actually have a little voicemail that I'm going to add in there from a listener from my previous, before the reboot has come back. So I'll put that in there and somewhere I'll edit it in there. Maybe after the listen, it'll be the ending credit. So again, thank you very much for listening, and never stop learning.
Hi again, Bjorn. Well, it's the Nordic way, Bjorn, you know. Anyway, now I managed to find the Ed Listen podcast on Apple Podcasts. So good work. Take care, and see you later on air, I hope.